that's like a really exciting aspect of it, right? Like,
yeah,
it's able to create this digital scarcity through proof of work, which is this very tangible bridge between like our physical natural world and this digital world that we're creating. And that is a very significant development in our technology.
What's going on, everyone? I'm John Chenot, and welcome to episode 19 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. In this episode, I'm excited to share part one of my Meet the Miami Plebs series. I'm sharing conversations with local Miami Bitcoiners as we approach the Bitcoin 2021 conference so that you can kind of peer into the solid community that's growing here. As the host of the Miami Bitcoiners Meetup, I get to meet some awesome people here, and this is just a way for you to get to know a couple of them. Sean is a fellow Bitcoiner who has been leading the BitDevs South Florida Meetup out of Fort Lauderdale. It's been a pleasure to get to know him over the last few months during my time here in Miami, and I really enjoyed this chat with him. We talk about Sean's background in Bitcoin, maintaining a skeptical view of Bitcoin along with everything else, experience with the BitDevs meetup, dollars, how dollars only have value because people are forced to use them, the untold history of Bitcoin, get into some cool fun stories that aren't really propagated as much as they should be. The recent ransomware attack on the Colonial Pipeline, and Sean's thoughts about Bitcoin and Miami in general. As always, if you want to support the show, be sure to like, subscribe, and share it with anyone that you think might resonate with it. And visit thebitcoinpath.com to learn about other events and ways to contribute. For those of you who are coming out to Miami for the Bitcoin 2021 conference this June, Jason DeLuzio and I are throwing the Have Fun Staying Pleb unofficial kickoff party for the conference on June 3rd, which is Thursday. Tickets are on sale at plebparty.com. And if you pay with Bitcoin or Lightning, you'll get a 10% off discount with the code Plebs Use Bitcoin in all caps. I really hope to see you all there. With that, let's get into this episode with Sean. All right. Well, Sean, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks, John. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you on. I really appreciated getting to know you over the last few months, having moved down to Miami here. Can you give just a brief introduction? Like, I know who you are, obviously, but the audience doesn't necessarily. So, you know, just a brief introduction of who you are and kind of what you're up to.
Yeah. So I've kind of I've just been in the Bitcoin scene for a few years now. Just kind of somebody that has actively paid attention to Bitcoin. I try to learn as much as possible about it. And within the last year or so, I have been doing these BitDevs meetups that are, they're essentially these meetups that focus on the technical aspects of Bitcoin and related protocols. So instead of just having like a high level or surface level discussion of Bitcoin, getting more into like the technicals of like what's going on, how the protocol works, some active developments, new ideas out there. And that's kind of been my thing that I've been doing in South Florida for the time being.
Awesome, dude. Yeah, and I've been able to attend a couple of them, and it's just been amazing to get into those conversations on more of the technical end of what's going on with the protocol and get some updates in terms of what's new developments and things that are going on.
And, Well, I was just going to say, when I first got into Bitcoin, I really did not have that level of technical knowledge. And when I first got in, we were doing meetups in South Florida, and there was a kind of a group of people that would meet up and talk about Bitcoin and just kind of look at the space in general, and kind of what you've been doing with the stuff in Miami. And so BitDev's it's not really like a formal organization or anything, but I do want to kind of maybe explain what it is and kind of how it got started.
Yeah,
because I think that credit is due to Justin, who started BitDevs in New York City some years ago. And the format that he kind of ran with was this like 2-hour session in the style of a Socratic seminar, where he would curate various technical topics. So this could be anything from, maybe a white paper touching on something related to like Bitcoin's like network level security. It could be like the latest news on some type of like new soft fork activation feature, like, back then maybe SegWit, now maybe Taproot. I know you've come out, we've discussed the Taproot soft fork a little bit. It could also just be like pull requests to Bitcoin Core or other projects, but he got this started, and it's just kind of a cool format. I think for a lot of people that get into the space and get into Bitcoin and learn more about it, even if you're not very technical, even if you're still kind of in the process of wrapping your head around how this thing works, it's definitely a way to get exposed to all of the things that are happening, that are not just about like the price or how much Bitcoin Michael Saylor just bought, but actually, all of the work that is getting done in terms of development. There have been other technically focused Bitcoin meetups around the world, that have kind of ran with that BitDevs format, and kind of just seeing what Justin got started and how he did that. I was like, South Florida needs one. Like, there's people down here like myself who are interested in learning more about it. I am a programmer by trade, but for people that are just, developers or interested in the technical stuff, like let's fucking do it and get a BitDevs meetup, started down here. So that was kind of my motivation for starting this thing. And then, doing this every month, it kind of got started, and then COVID happened, and then we got back up and running last October. It's been a really fun thing to do, and I've learned a lot myself. So, oh shoot, I think I just lost your audio.
No, that's my bad. I had it on mute because they just happened to be like tearing up the street in front of my apartment here, and so they're like just banging the shit out of the ground with like excavators and everything. It's just like been a constant like bam, bam, bam.
Oh man.
So hopefully I was testing the background, and hopefully it's not too bad. But perks of living in a city, right?
Yeah, so, especially down here where there's like continuous construction all the time,
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. So I should have mentioned a little bit of this before we launched, but the whole purpose of this little Miami pleb series is really to, Miami is getting a lot of attention right now in the Bitcoin space, right? And it's one of the reasons that I came down here initially, but I was already had some plans. I had a buddy who's moving down here, and I came down with him to check it out. But there's a lot of cool things and a lot of exciting new developments, and also the conference is coming up in June, and so a lot of Bitcoiners are going to be coming down here for the conference. And so I wanted to just publish like a a few podcasts interacting with local Miami Bitcoiners to kind of give people an understanding of what it's like down here and what the actual, some interesting projects that are going on in terms of in the Bitcoin world in Miami. And I think your South Florida, well, it's not technically in Miami, but it's South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, and the Bit Devs meetup in my experience has been just an extremely valuable gathering, and especially getting some feedback from some of the other people who have attended yours and then gone to even the Austin Bit Devs, comparing and contrasting them. It's been high quality, to say the least. So, yeah, man, that's kind of where I'm coming from with this. And I'd love to just kind of get a little bit more of your background. So you mentioned you're a programmer by trade and mm-hmm. came into Bitcoin a few years ago, but, I'd like to hear a little bit more of like your personal journey of what is it about Bitcoin that attracted you to it? And what has that journey been like for you?
Yeah. So I would say that my first year in Bitcoin was in 2014. So it was kind of following the price run up that had occurred the year before. So basically, like, you hear about this thing that is going up in value, and that kind of gets you, for a lot of people, I think that's kind of how they first had heard about it. And then when you start learning a little bit about like what this thing actually is, it I think for a lot of people, it becomes more apparent that it's much bigger than just something that you can make some money off of or something like that, when I first like kind of started with Bitcoin, I was actually just like I was working as like an IT recruiter. So I was just a recruiter, like with an independent firm, involved with working with like other programmers and IT people, because those were like, the companies or the people that I was like placing. And I think it may have been through like one of the programmers that I had become friends with, even first heard the term Bitcoin. And, I just didn't really know that much about, technology, or I was kind of just learning about technology. I really had no idea about, the nature of money. And, 2014, the first meetup that I went out to in South Florida, I met, basically the guys that were running it were these guys named Jun Seth and Chris DeRose, who went on to have one of the most infamous podcasts in the entire Bitcoin space, called Bitcoin Uncensored. And, I was kind of like somebody that would just, listen to the podcast, but I also like knew them, and we'd have our like, South Florida local community. I mean, we were meeting up like every week. We would be talking about stuff going on in Bitcoin. There would be so many people showing up with like other ideas, and they were promoting scams often, or they were like really into something like BitShares, and they were trying to like articulate why they thought this was like a good idea. And, there's a lot of unknowns. The space, the journey for me has really just been like understanding things from the different areas that Bitcoin touches, like the technical aspects, the economic aspects, the like what is money actually, like how does the financial system work aspects, how does like regulation function into this, like how does Bitcoin kind of fit into the world picture, and from a position of being like a Bitcoin person looking at Bitcoin, and then you kind of started, reevaluating and examining a lot of other things. It, It's just kind of like a, like for example, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this. I think we've kind of touched on this in the past. But you know, Bitcoin today, like there's a lot more institutional investment, I think, coming in or has come in, or probably continue to come in. But those first few years for me with Bitcoin, like, there are a lot of weird risks that were like weren't fully known. Like there were a lot of things that we were like it was approached with skepticism. So it wasn't just skepticism of other types of projects, but it was actually like, you know, can we maintain a skeptical view of Bitcoin and say like, well, this thing does seem to be the thing that's going to succeed in the long run. And I don't think Bitcoin's going to go anywhere anytime soon, but like, what are the risks to it? You know, there were incidences that are like really important, I think, in Bitcoin history, that I think for anybody coming in now, it's just not common knowledge. The Backpage incident comes to my mind. Do you know about Backpage.com? Have you heard of that? Have I talked about that with you? So Backpage.com. Yeah. So it's a site that, it got taken down a couple of years ago. But it essentially looked like a Craigslist clone. So people could put their ads on this page, but funny enough, it wasn't really used for like normal day items. The only section that had any activity was the adult section, and Backpage was primarily used for, prostitutes, sex workers, whatever you want to call them, to advertise the adults. Yes. that kind of adult. That's by the way, South Florida, there's a, I feel like the people down here were more aware of Backpage and what it was than other places in the country. But, so like, you know, it's kind of like a weird thing to maybe bring up, but I think it's really important in Bitcoin's history because, So basically you had all of these sex workers using the site to advertise their services. And I think it was either 2015 or 2016. I forget the name of it, but I think that there was a large crackdown on like various types of like there was, I think this was because like something within the Obama administration that was like ramping up their regulation and enforcement of financial crimes. And the incident in 2015, 2016 was that Backpage, all of the credit card companies cut off their services to the site. So when that happened, and I think they had either started accepting Bitcoin as payment or they because of that, they started accepting Bitcoin as payment. You had all of these users of the site, the men and women posting these ads that they needed a way to pay for those ads. And Bitcoin was the only method of payment that they could use. So they didn't care about the protocol. They didn't care about like the financial system really. All they knew is that they needed a way to pay for this. Their livelihood rested on it. And Bitcoin was the, they got into it because they, you know, they needed it. So, you know, those early years, there was a big emphasis on like, what is the actual like need and use case here? Like, why do we need this? You know, people are talking about like, and this kind of gets back into like, the things Roger Ver used to say, like, oh, you know, Bitcoin, people are going to use it to pay for their coffee. And it's like, well, when you really break it down, you know, maybe in the future, but there seems to be other use cases here. So like that Backpage incident is just coffee kind of like
sex.
Coffee and sex. Well, so the financial system, like there's a lot of people that are underserved, right? So whether you're talking about within the West, like people that are like offering sex services, whether you're talking about people that are, you know, operating or buying and selling like illicit substances like drugs, or even people that fall into that category that are just like in a very like bad situation, like Argentina, the people just have no other means of like storing their value, no usable type of currency. I'm hearing things like, you know, and countries around the world where You know, just due to the nature of those environments, a Bitcoin-shaped hole kind of opens up, right? So for people that have no alternative means, Bitcoin has, come to the, or it has provided that type of, like, you know, service and necessity. And for a lot of those years, it was, thinking about the underserved, like, and that's kind of what it gets, what you would call these people. They need Bitcoin. They needed Bitcoin. So that was always like a very like important thing that I think it still exists today. I think that is kind of like the nature of like how Bitcoin fits into the, like, the world economy. But at the same time, like, you have this more like banks are coming in now, and I think potentially offering, like, you know, or they're interested in building on Bitcoin and actually, like, you know, thinking of this as like the financial system 2.0 and moving forward with it. But yeah, I mean, like, there's a lot of different sides of it, right? So, I guess, like, kind of like, you know, like, these incidences were happening as we were, like, doing these meetups. So it'd be a very active discussion, of, like, you know, who these people are that need it. And then, like, where is this, like, where is Bitcoin? And then where is the entire space going, in terms of, like, the actual, like, use cases and you know, how it fits into the world, I guess.
Right. So was that kind of like, did it feel a little bit like you were, I mean, you get, it was much more on the fringes, right? I mean, today, even today, it still feels as though Bitcoin, this is the Bitcoin world and then the real world. And most of, like, you walk around and most of your normie friends or whatever don't really have any idea of what's actually going on with the Bitcoin protocol and why it's significant. But back in that time, it was like way more so on the fringes. And so
yeah,
that's kind of what you're saying, right? And there was a lot more uncertainty as well as to how things were going to develop, in terms of, like, how governments were going to respond to it, how the larger institutions were going to eventually respond to it. More it was like, so what was it that, like, was it the freedom, just the independence aspect of it that attracted you to it, or the technical progress that it represented, or was it kind of all of the above?
Well, I mean, I would say it was kind of all of the above. I think it was just like, you know, like Bitcoin's invention, like, it was kind of like a meteor crashed on the planet Earth, and like some type of alien substance kind of like came out, and there were only a very small amount of people that were like looking at this alien substance and playing with it. And it's like, well, how is this alien substance, like, this exists now, like, this is part of our universe. How does this exist as more people, like, get a hold of it? How are governments going to react to this? How are, like, what does this thing mean? And, you know, I'm not like a, like, I know there's always been like a heavy libertarian perspective on, like, rebuilding a financial system on sound money, for example, or, you know, people look at it like, you know, they think the financial system or the dollar should have been not decoupled from gold or something. But it's really just like, this thing is really weird. It's like, why is this, why are people into this? Why is this working? Like, why is this so resilient to, being, like, governments can come in and do things, but it's like, oh, well, Bitcoin, it seems like this is like not a this is an unstoppable force. It's aiming to create this decentralized new type of digital money, and it cannot be easily like coerced or controlled by a single entity, whether that's a government or just like a large collective of various centralized organizations. Why is that? Like, why is this the thing that is able to do that? And why is it the thing that is able to maintain that to a certain extent going forward as a long-term thing? And, you know, the thing that Satoshi figured out was how to take something, taking this proof of work concept and actually applying it when it came to creating a digital, money, a cryptocurrency. And, you know, we would have conversations that, like, you know, is this burning of energy to order transactions and maintain this blockchain system? Like, does this mean that it's like a naturally occurring thing now? You know, it kind of, you know, there's a lot of these ideas and papers I've seen, and people talk about like this idea of like, well, what is Bitcoin, like in a very like meta level type of, like, is it an entity? Is it like, it's like this decentralized system, but like, what does that kind of mean in like a metaphysical sense, you know? And, even if you shut down like mining operations in the United States and in China, and governments like crack down on it heavily, there is always this system that is decentralized enough to keep carrying on. And there's always this, like, anybody can just start spinning up a mining operation and push it and moving the chain forward. So like, if it's just always available, it's completely independent of, you know, governments and organizations of people. Like, it's this weird thing that exists in the universe now. I guess you could say that, like, you know, back to your question, like, the technicals from that perspective have always been interesting to me. I guess like the autonomy of it has been something that's appealing, but it's just such a interesting technology that is very different than, something like AI or machine learning or, you know, the latest social network that, it's always just been really attractive in that nature. So I don't know if maybe I'm rambling a little bit too much, but it's like I said, the alien substance analogy, I guess, is kind of the thing, right? Because, it's just a constant question of like, what is this? How does this fit into the picture? I mean, like, we've had all of these events that have happened in recent years, everything from like the Trump administration and like this censorship that's going on social media, you know, this whole COVID thing and like the overreach of governments, like, you know, something, even when you kind of just look at it, you know, look at these events, it's like, well, how does Bitcoin fit into the picture? Like where is the trajectory for Bitcoin in this world that is, you know, changing and moving forward? We're living in this world. We have to deal with the consequences of it. Yeah, I mean, it's for those reasons, even Bitcoin as a framework for understanding the rest of the world, like, that's always kind of been a thought in my head.
It definitely, I had a similar, you know, progression of realizations, I suppose, as I look back on how I was kind of grappling with this. And one of the things that I've thought about is that, like, this is, like you said, it's something that is here to stay, and it's perpetuating itself through time. That's pretty much unstoppable in a pretty much unstoppable way. So it's here, and it's something that we can rely on being here. So it's there. It's almost like a, you know, I've heard it called, referred to in this type of way as of like a new force of nature in some respects, where it's like, or it's a connection between the informational digital realm and the material world, because of the way that it takes proof of work and applies it into this store of value, and into this new monetary network.
That's like a really exciting aspect of it, right? Like,
yeah,
it's able to create this digital scarcity through proof of work, which is this very tangible bridge between like our physical natural world and this digital world that we're creating. And that is a very significant development in our technology. And you know, that's kind of like the big, like that's such a core aspect of it. It can't get discussed enough, you know?
Yeah, man. And I was just, it's so funny that, well, it's not funny, but it's crazy to me that the proof of work aspect is something that people like poo-poo and think that is outdated or some way somehow unsustainable into the future. And I was talking to this a bit with some normie friends that I was on a boat with on Saturday, who were kind of, because yeah, they just read articles and they'll read the environmentalist type FUD, fear, uncertainty and doubt that is propagated through like the mainstream media and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, oh, well, proof of work is, you know, is shown to be like this unsustainable and bad for the environment, all this kind of stuff. And what about proof of stake? That's going to have to be the future, right? And so maybe we can dig into that a little bit of like, why is proof of work so important, and why is it fundamental to the Bitcoin network? And then why is that? Because to me, I see it, because that is a fundamental aspect of the Bitcoin network. That's why the Bitcoin network is superior. And that's why it's, it has better properties, in all these ways.
Yeah. So in the entire discussion, and this discussion probably predates Bitcoin to some extent, of how do you actually like make a system like this work? How do you keep it decentralized in a way that is going to, you know, prevent some type of like takeover or centralized, the security involved is maintaining, like, even if you have something that's very distributed, if it can kind of get, you know, controlled or have a huge ownership of like just a handful of actors, like you're going to have to deal with a system that is not very robust against whatever actions that they want to take and is kind of dependent on those entities existing. So the proof of work, you know, to have a system that is actually like, so miners are burning this energy. They're hashing, a block. So they're going through this proof of work process of actually, collecting transactions, hashing them, and proving that they have done a significant amount of work, in order to like win that block and actually say, this is the next block in this history. So the question is always like, well, how do you have a system and how that, like, who decides the transaction ordering, like who decides what transactions get in, what transactions don't. And, the proof of stake people, like there's been a lot of research and discussion about this, and this topic always gets brought up. The thing that always pops into my head is when Ethereum first kind of appeared onto the scene, they were like, well, we're going to do proof of work for now, but we're working on proof of stake systems. And the thing with proof of stake is like you have people that are like owning the token that are like staking it, or they're going through some process where they're deciding the ordering of the ledger. They're deciding what transactions are valid or invalid, based off of like this staking system. But it's been discussed and kind of proven that like over a long period of time, there's the various attacks of like, you know, acquiring larger portions of stake, other weird scenarios that are just very vulnerable to central entities being able to decide the affect transactions and decide the history of the ledger. It's always a matter of like, how do you actually, like, if you're going to move forward with that, how do you bootstrap that process? Like if you want to look at the Ethereum as an example, like even if they moved to proof of stake, like a huge portion of Ether is held by like the Ethereum Foundation, a huge portion is held by exchanges. So even from the onset of that, of saying, this is the mechanism we're going to use to have this type of system, you have a huge problem of centralization. You have just a handful of actors that are in control ultimately of that blockchain. Some people might say, well, maybe that's okay. But again, like, you want to build something that is going to last not just in your lifetime, but your children's lifetime, your children's lifetime. It has to achieve a long-term level of security and decentralization where it cannot be attacked or controlled by just a handful of actors. So proof of work, like, it's like anybody can mine. Like, I obviously there's like realities of mining where it can only be done at a certain scale at this point, just due to the difficulty increases. But it's a perfectly mining is a really cool thing because it's a perfectly commoditized market. Like, it's Bitcoin's kind of like a perfect commodity in that it doesn't really matter if like people in the US are mining Bitcoin, if China is mining Bitcoin, if North Korea is mining Bitcoin. Like, everybody has to operate at a very, essentially the same level. And even if you have like in the long run, like miners are consistently competing to do that transaction ordering. It's the best thing we have to achieving that level of decentralization for a long term money. So it's the best we have. It's kind of the reason that we're here with Bitcoin. I think when people talk about it in a way of like, oh, proof of work is like this energy intensive, wasteful thing. I mean, one response is to say, well, just get the government to ban mining. Like, go ahead, like kick all these American mining companies spinning up, like, go ahead and kick them out. Because it doesn't really matter. Like if you remove the miners from the US or you remove the miners from China, mining's going to happen somewhere on the planet. Like, you, there's this giant incentive to perform this mining operation. And it's kind of just like, to me, that kind of is it's kind of an interesting aspect of how Bitcoin works, you know? Look, you're going to have these other systems. Like, you know, one thing that was always kind of a thought is like, well, Ethereum is going to be centralized to an extent way more than Bitcoin. Any other type of like proof of stake system is going to be vulnerable to becoming more centralized. It's not a good long-term thing. I guess the question is like, well, like, how can we actually like define the parameters of like what is short-term, what is medium-term, what is long-term? So you're going to have these other blockchain systems, I think, around for some time. I would have, you know, maybe back in 2016 made the bet that Ethereum would be, you know, not as long, it would have died off maybe a little bit sooner. And I think a lot of the maybe like current incumbents within the financial system are going to look at the space. They're going to buy Bitcoin. They're going to think, I think they're going to come to the conclusion that Bitcoin is the ultimate long-term asset. But you know, the fact that these other systems are centralized enough that they can take control over it, I think that's like, I think you're going to have that as well. Which is kind of unfortunate, but I think that's just kind of the nature of the game. You know, these entities and powers want a level of control over wherever this goes, and they might see that in those types of systems, you know. But yeah, I mean, that's like, you know, for anybody that kind of is new to this space, like, you have to kind of understand like this proof of work aspect to understand why Bitcoin is the long-term winner. Or at least the thesis here, the scientific analysis of blockchain is that only proof of work works in the long run. Proof of work blockchains compete. And Bitcoin is, you know, it's the power of its network effect, its liquidity, its brand, it's known now, I think, as like this digital gold. Or at least that's part of like what it's kind of perceived as. Like that's why it is the best thing to focus on and you know, really the only thing to spend any significant amount of time on, because it's the long-term thing. Like, you know, I really like that book Layered Money by Nick Bhatia, because I think it kind of puts Bitcoin in a very useful framework when it comes to analyzing this space, as like, this is a new type of money that's forming a base layer. And going forward, you're going to see other layers built on top of Bitcoin. And, you know, like, for all of the reasons I just said, it's going to maintain that status as the base layer.
Yeah. Something that helped me to understand proof of work was to think of like how, and the significance of, well, its significance for the network is thinking about how in order for there to be a Bitcoin in existence today, there had to be an expenditure of energy by a computer at a certain point in time. And it can be, so it's like, it's actually proven that like, if you have Bitcoin, there was like a certain amount of energy that was expended to produce that Bitcoin in the past, at a certain point in the past. And so, yeah, I would much rather depend on the laws of physics, even though there are a lot of, you know, new theories and, you know, we wonder like how much we can rely even on the laws of physics, but like I'd rather rely on that than like a group knowing that that people who own this thing are able to produce it or to validate the transactions and validate what is in existence. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but just kind of reflecting on that myself.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think even if people, you know, like, I just say, like, let's say, like, large hedge funds or, like, you know, like, these George Soros types or, like, you know, these old institutions and funds that have billions and say, mm-hmm. we see this entire space as the future. You know, we see this growing. We see new financial technologies being built on top of it. You know, they're going to look at it and they might say, well, we like, you know, we're really into this DeFi thing, so we're into like Ethereum, or they see the value in the proof of stake stuff.
Yeah, because it's similar to what they have already.
So kind of the thing. Like they might look at Ethereum as like, well, like there's just going to be there's a very straightforward way to kind of capturing this over the long run and maintaining a level of control of it that benefits them. So whether it's like, you know, it's like current people, it's maybe like new people. So like whoever is kind of like running the Ethereum Foundation, like maybe they kind of see themselves as like the new financial elite that can kind of like control this type of system. You know, at the end of the day, like everybody is still going to make the bet that Bitcoin is the thing that is not that, and that can maintain a level of decentralization. So even if you are like, you know, you are just trying to control this, you see Bitcoin as the best asset to own and hold. And you know, that's kind of an interesting shift in the narrative I noticed kind of leading up to this. For obvious reasons, I always want to, you know, Bitcoin's the thing to focus on, but you know, with these bull market cycles, all of the shit coins come out, and they you know, everybody has a way to justify a token that they can just, you know, sell and get more Bitcoin with.
Right.
But like some people are looking at some of this DeFi stuff, and the narrative now, like you have Ethereum, you have the Binance chain, you have like some of these other proof of stake projects like Solana that are all trying to, like everybody kind of recognizes Bitcoin as like the king. Like there's this idea that Bitcoin is Bitcoin. It's the long-term winner. It's the thing that everybody wants. And they're all competing. All these chains are kind of competing with each other for this like DeFi ecosystem. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing to look at. You know, like there's a very applied and active science here of blockchain. That's how I always think of it. So when we talk about like the Bitcoin maximalism and like what that means and why people are that way, I just kind of see it as like a conclusion after analyzing the science of blockchain and what makes, you know, what makes the most sense for the everyday person to say, hey, like I have a use case, whether that's a store of value, because it's not worth, you know, they're kind of going down in comparison, or they're depreciating, or you are in a world where financially you're getting censored. You know, Bitcoin is the, Bitcoin's the asset to gravitate towards. So, I just think that's kind of a thing maybe to point out. I don't completely ignore, you know, the stuff that's kind of happening outside of Bitcoin, but even when I do evaluate it, I still see, you know, Bitcoin as the king. So,
yeah, it's I almost see it as they're playing an entirely different game. It's like, oh well, Bitcoin won the money thing, so I have to go and, you know, we have this other little sandbox that we can play in for now.
It's always the same shit, dude. It's always like all these people that issue, like they do these projects. Like, you know, there's kind of a range of scamness to them. Like, so you have people that just blatantly, it's just a money grab. It's just a way to get more Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Dump on people that they can sell it to. I think there are people that kind of enter it saying, well, we're going to create a token, but like we really care about the project, and we really, you know, like, but it's kind of, there's kind of a level of scamness even to that, because they don't, like when you evaluate those projects, it's like there really isn't like a huge need for a token other than a way for investors to get their money back into these other types of chains, right? So like there's this stuff going on with like stable coins, which I know is kind of a buzzword, but like, and you know, so you're going to have existing fiat currencies that are going to get, and they are already onboarded onto like Bitcoin or just like these general chains. Tether has been kind of like the prime example of that for a number of years. Mm-hmm. You just have these digital tokens that can be redeemed for dollars with the Tether bank or whatever. But there's these projects that are like they're trying to like put up an asset as collateral and adjust that asset in a way to create a dollar stable coin. So that's where you see some of these projects like DAI or whatever. But it's just kind of funny because it's never just like Ethereum and the stable coin. There's always like a secondary token that they create. And they might, you know, they'll try to justify the existence of that token and say, well, it's like, you know, it's used in this ecosystem. It's used for this, it's used for that. But it just kind of harms, like, it's just not very, like there isn't a huge need for it. And, there's a level of like, it's just not needed. And like I said, it's just a way to, it's just kind of a way to speculate and capture a value. It's just kind of a way to speculate and capture a value of these projects in a very, not very honest way. So.
Right. Yeah, man. Well, I think we've given enough airtime to the shit coins for today.
Yeah. But the thing that I would want to leap off there is that one thing about Bitcoin maximalism, like Bitcoin is growing and it's scaling in a way that maintains that level of decentralization. So like Bitcoin's development philosophy is very conservative. Bitcoin developers are not just, and I say developers, but the entire ecosystem, users, people that are, you know, pay attention to the space. Everybody knows that you can't just willy-nilly like add in features and try to like, you know, take the Silicon Valley approach of like moving fast and breaking things. Things need to scale. You know, new innovations can come to Bitcoin, but they have to be done in a way that scales Bitcoin and doesn't lose that level of decentralization. And I would say that whatever these other chains are doing that turns out to be maybe somewhat useful or something that people might actually find valuable, there's a way, and there's going to continue to be a way to bring that to Bitcoin. So if you want to do some type of collateral-backed stablecoin, I would say something like sidechains, you're going to be able to bring that type of value to the Bitcoin ecosystem. So where these other projects are going down that like Silicon Valley mindset of move fast, break things, we're not going to care about the long term as much, we're not going to focus on like maintaining a level of decentralization, we're just going to like move forward and, you know, very quickly with these things. Bitcoin's taking a much more long-term approach, but there's still innovations happening. There's still things getting added to the protocol. There's people working on projects in this space that can bring those types of, innovations to Bitcoin. The sidechain ecosystem, I think is within Bitcoin is becoming more active. If you really if you really want to like do some type of these like smart contracting things with the EVM, a lot of people don't know that there is a sidechain called RSK, formerly known as Rootstock, that is a sidechain of Bitcoin that has that usability. Like they have the EVM attached to them. If you want, features like quicker settlement or confidential transactions, Blockstream's Liquid is a sidechain that provides that. And, I think he moved down to Miami for some time and you've met him, but Paul Storz has been working on this concept of drive chain, which is, you know, so far as I can tell, the best decentralized way to achieve a two-way peg with Bitcoin. So basically the idea is that you want to have a way to move Bitcoin onto a sidechain and move that Bitcoin on the sidechain back to Bitcoin in as trustless a manner as possible, right? And that does not harm or compete with Bitcoin's 21 million cap. It only adds to Bitcoin's capabilities because you still have this hard limit of Bitcoin and you're just moving those coins onto a chain with different properties. And in the long run, like, I think that is the way to do all of these other things that these other chains say they can do. So if there's any usability, if there's any utility, if there's things people want in these other projects, like there's a path forward to bring them to Bitcoin. And I think that is something to, you know, keep in mind.
Yeah, 100%. I like, I heard CK with Bitcoin Magazine talk about like how a lot of these projects are, shitcoins are all ultimately part of Bitcoin in some capacity, because anything that they are working on that they can, that is actually quality and lasting into the future can ultimately be added on in the future to Bitcoin. So it's almost like you have these like outside other, like, I don't know, multi-species, like exploratory systems that are, some are more scammy than others, of course, but they're exploring this technological realm and testing things that could possibly have use in the future. So there's that. So earlier before we went on air, Sean, we were talking about this ransomware attack. And
oh yeah.
So this is kind of a current event, something that's developing right now. And can you kind of explain a little bit of what exactly happened and what kind of significance that has for us right now?
Yeah. Another, and I didn't even mention this before, but these Bitcoin shaped holes that open up in the universe, I think ransomware is a very important part of that. So ransomware, what that is hackers attacking a computer system, locking it up and demanding payment in order to unlock those systems. And though they've only been growing like in this space for many years, there've been an increase in these ransomware attacks. And it's, I think, been an important thing because it's part of the Bitcoin world. And it's always like, well, how does Bitcoin fit into the larger picture of our world, our financial system, our government, and ransomware is always kind of like this really exciting area. I'm looking right now. Krebs on Security is a great website that does cybersecurity analysis. They have some pretty good research pieces, and I haven't read through this one yet because I think it just came out. But there was a ransomware attack on something called the Colonial Pipeline, which stretches from, looking at this map, I think New Jersey all the way like through the Southeast into Texas. So I was mentioning
security.com.
Krebs on security.com. Krebs with a K, by the way.
Oh, Krebs.
Yeah. So I heard about this last week, and it seems like this is pretty significant because ransomware attacks, there have been a lot of stories about them from private companies or even like hospitals. This is a pretty large piece of U.S. infrastructure that goes beyond the private sector. And I'm not sure, there's this piece here saying that it's the group taking responsibility for it is the Dark Side cybercrime gang. But the point is, like, if they have successfully executed an attack on U.S. infrastructure, and they're demanding payment, it seems here that there's negotiations still going on. And it's like, you know, is the U.S. going to, are they going to pay it? Are they not going to pay it? Is it really like what it's getting reported as? Is there more to this picture, you know? Either way, like, it's affecting a large, gas pipeline in within the U.S. Southeast. And I'm hearing over the last few days reports in places like the Carolinas that there's a gas shortage. I don't know if down here in South Florida there is an actual gas shortage. I'm not really sure if we're affected by it. But, you know, I filled up my gas tank yesterday because, kind of like with the toilet paper incident last year at the start of this COVID stuff, whether there's a shortage or not, people think there is, and everyone rushes to get as much of it as possible, and then that therefore causes a shortage.
Right.
So, these types of incidences, like, especially since it's specifically ransomware, and I still kind of need to see what the details here are. It's a significant event to pay attention to. Does the U.S. government or various agencies react to things like this? Do things get paid out? Do they not get paid out? Are governments going to use this as a, like, you know, talking point to push forward certain types of regulation? Like, that's always kind of a thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. These things happen and then... Exactly. Right. So I think it's, I think for anybody that is, looking for things to pay attention to in this space, this incident specifically seems pretty significant. So.
Yeah. It's fascinating that there are, well, we're seeing it. We're kind of in transition, right, into the information age, and there's still significant parts of our infrastructure. We're still much of our country and much of the world is still running on like very old technology and old, very vulnerable systems, right? Even what's fascinating about, I was in Austin a few weeks ago, and we were talking to some of the locals there about that incident where they're out of power during like this ice storm. Mm. And there was just like a massive breakdown in the existing electrical infrastructure. And it was really interesting to look at because we go through our lives, we think that things are a certain way, and we have this like bias to normalcy bias, right, where we think that the way things are is the way things will be, and it's not always the case, as we can see. These types of things happen pretty fast.
Right. Well, we're born in, we're both U.S. born, and we're born into this country that has all of this wealth and infrastructure that has already been put in place. And I think from a political perspective, we're part of this large empire that's on the decline. And that decline comes out in events and incidences where the system has become so degenerated or bloated that we have old infrastructure. There's areas where it's failing. The political forces that need to react to these types of events are not encumbered with the best intention or most efficient types of people to be working there and handling this and taking care of these things. So even in cases where and I heard this with Texas, they just didn't expect those temperatures at that period of time. And that might be pretty reasonable. Is the response to those types of things something that could be better? And like you said, we kind of take for granted that those things are around and that they exist. But I don't know, these systems might have levels of failure and degeneration that we're going to see going forward. And especially when it comes to our computer systems, I think the ransomware thing is always really interesting because it just provides this very direct incentive to attack these systems. And that is going to exacerbate all of these flaws and weaknesses in our computerized infrastructure and software through companies and government. And I know we live in this world where we're glad to be Bitcoiners and we like the fact that Bitcoin's growing. But we have to live in this world where these incidences exist and there are larger entities that are responding to them. And I'm not always sure exactly.
Bitcoin takes center stage, of course, because it provides the ability to extort someone very well. Just by providing that payment avenue.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a financial network that can't be censored. So when you have uncensorable money, you have the ability to do these types of things. And, it increases the incentives for these types of attacks to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, has that given you a little more? Has that given you personally a little more conscientiousness when it comes to your personal security and your digital security, privacy, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean,
or do you see more of the threats on? Like a grander scale, there are bigger attacks or bigger honeypots for people to focus on before they start looking at the plebs.
Yeah. I mean, right. Well, from the onset of getting into the space, you want to be very conscious of your own security and how you, not just maybe deal with your Bitcoin, but your online activities, whatever type of computer you use. So I've always been fairly security conscious, and not too pretty much what I don't really want to repeat the common things that a lot of Bitcoiners talk about with their own personal security. I definitely agree with, things like with what Matt Odell talks about when it comes to holding and using Bitcoin, or making sure that I've never really been a big Windows user, for example. Maybe the latest versions of Windows are a little bit more secure, but I've always been a Linux guy, even just for a desktop system. That's always been there. I think the bigger institutions and the bigger holders that are, have a significant amount of attack vector are more susceptible to that type of thing.
Yeah, for sure. So moving, just thinking back to, so today we've got, I've, the Miami Bitcoiners meet up and, we have 40 people going to attend, it's interesting that, what I've noticed is there's 80% almost of people who are coming to the meetup are like new people. And then some, a lot of them are Bitcoiners who are from other parts of the country that are just visiting and checking out Miami, or I've run into a lot of just nomadic Bitcoiners who are traveling, and whether they're European or from other countries, and they're just kind of coming through. And one of the things that one of the guys who came to the firearm training that I hosted on Friday, he mentioned that like in Europe and in other parts of the world, Florida and Texas are like the beacons of hope for them. like they are, and I kind of like, I'm chuckling at the same, just because like, here we are in the midst of them. And it's like, and it's not, it's just like normal, right? It's not like things are just, we're heaven on earth here in Miami.
Well,
yet, but
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Florida and Texas are examples of places that are, you know, maintaining levels of like freedom and not, you know, like for example, like all of the gyms that at this point that I frequent, there's no mask requirement. It's completely optional. A lot of places are completely optional. The state has, you know, put those forward. And it's kind of like, you know, coming back to some level of normalcy. Mm-hmm. It's really crazy when you compare it to other places, you know, like New York or California, where like they're still, you know, they've been much more extreme in their restrictions throughout this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And they're continuing to be that way. I mean, look, like, you know, there's this move of people that are coming down here, and I think it's great, I guess. I mean, I'm not even sure it's great, because like, you know, as more people come down here and frequent, it's more likely that it's going to shift into something, you know, in the longer run. It's just like with Miami, it's nice weather. It's a big city. It's in the Eastern time zone. And I think it's just an attractive place for people who are able to move down here that are online, that want certain levels of freedom. They want to like get back to a level of normalcy. They don't need to be in New York. They don't need to be in Silicon Valley or, you know, San Francisco. And that's great. Like for right now, yeah, I think this is the place to be if you want that. But I'm a little skeptical in the long run of where it goes. You know, I mean, it might be fine for another 10 years. But like these, you know, the entire, like the government, just like places in New York, businesses, all these requirements of like, you know, mask wearing or requiring people to put an app on their phone to like track them it's Florida's definitely a place that's always kind of had like a level of freedom that people didn't know about. Like people kind of think of Florida as like this joke, like the Florida man meme or whatever. And it's kind of been a place where when people got kicked out of other states, they would come down here. And it's always kind of been more of like a little bit more of a wilder and crazier vibe than other places in the country. And, I think that'll continue for some time. Like it'll have a level of freedom that is just a little higher than other places. But I don't know, like I just, whatever we saw over this, you know, this past year, whatever is completely true, whatever is a little bit, you know, gray in terms of like what are the details of a disease, of an incident. I can see something like this happening again in the future. And I don't know what the country, I don't know for how long any singular place can resist the larger like forces that take away certain, you know, freedoms, restrictions of movement, you know, requirements of,
right.
Maybe that's just kind of like, I feel like I'm not being specific with anything I'm saying, but like, you know, from my perspective, you know, a lot of people are moving here, but from my perspective, it's like, you know, if this place is going to become New York in the future, like where's the next place to go to? And that's kind of at the back of my mind, you know?
Mm-hmm. 100%. I think the same way. And you know, what comes to mind is this sovereign individual thesis sovereign individual, where they talk about, jurisdictional arbitrage, and
I think the more different cities and states or local municipalities are able to compete with each other for on the level of personal freedoms for individuals that they're within their jurisdiction, the better things will become. But there, I get what you're saying, like that there is, it is somewhat overwhelming to look at like how much of the world just became somewhat dystopian over the last year, in terms of their government overreach, in terms of the tracking and the regulatory arbitrary regulations on businesses and restrictions and all those types of things. And it does, like, I get that it's exciting to see the Miami mayor talk about Bitcoin and have all these politicians with laser eyes on their Twitter accounts and be like, oh man, they're like talking, you know, they're making it like mainstream in these ways. But we have to be skeptical of that, right? Like we have to just see like, what are their motives? What are people always act within just like based on their own incentives. And so Miami mayor, his incentive is to capitalize on this moment to like get as much money into the city and as much attention into the city as possible. And like, so I,
yeah, I mean, he's going to ride that trend. And that's fine. It's just like,
right.
You know, I love the memes in the space. But the one meme that I kind of like there's the meme of Bitcoin fixes this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that despite even good intentions, even if I assume the best of somebody like the Miami mayor, there are more, the problems that I see coming are bigger than just, you know, one politician or like one, you know, local government or anything like that. There seems to be a bigger reason why everything's going in this direction, and it's much more complicated. And I think, like, I'm not saying that, like, I don't really think Bitcoin fixes that, but it does provide a way out, or at least a way to kind of hedge against that.
Yes, it does,
for people. Yeah.
Fixes everything.
Well, so like, but it does provide, I mean, look, like, you know, bad government management, you know, the dollar inflate, the expansion of the money supply, its effect on other types of assets, all of these things, like if you're looking for a way to hedge against the dystopian of the world you're living in, Bitcoin does provide that. But at the same time, like, there is this dystopian system that you either have to like adapt to or deal with or leave. And like, I am skeptical of the claim that Bitcoin is going to like, you know, change or fix the problems that the current United States government kind of has. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's not really an anti-Bitcoin stance. It's just an anti, like Bitcoin might be a part of this, but there's a lot of other things involved. You know, it's a very large, complicated world. How we got here is not always like as obvious. It's not always well taught or well understood by even myself or anybody. And as the world goes, you know, like the geopolitical world, like right now, there's just like, there's this like framework of thinking of the US as like this declining empire and China's rising, or China's already kind of at our level and they're superseding us. Whatever that means, like, governments are reacting to this changing world. And then, like even to begin to think of how to fix the problems that we see, requires like a lot of understanding and focus on, like, my suggestion is, like, I don't know, like, if you're a Bitcoiner, like, definitely keep reading about other things. You know, think about, like, you know, I think a lot of the media and the news is mostly just propaganda, but I think there's a lot of value in history and books. And yeah, I mean, paying attention to places that, you know, either like Miami for right now, but maybe looking at other places around the world and saying, oh, actually, like, maybe the American spirit has to continue kind of, you know, maybe not physically within the US. I'm not sure. Like, there's a lot going on, and it's something to consistently analyze, evaluate, and discuss. And, like, it's always exciting to see how the future plays out. Like, I'm always very interested in it. I'm very positive about it personally. But that's just because, like, I feel pretty happy where I'm at. Right. But,
right.
I don't know, man. Yeah.
It's that dynamic world. Everything is changing very quickly, and economically, geopolitically, things can change very fast. Right. So that's, I think, one of the positive aspects of being involved in Bitcoin is the fact that, like, we can have a lot of flexibility in just, like, being able to adapt and transition to new physical spaces very quickly, and take the majority of our value, take whatever we and to take our community as well. Like, so that's one of why I've tried to focus on, for one, like, just understanding Bitcoin as much as possible. And then secondly, like, connecting with other Bitcoiners and networking as much as possible and building community in my local vicinity, hosting the Miami Bitcoiners meetup and really focusing on that. And then also focusing on skill development. So, like, real practical skills, and also building knowledge and learning as well, but skills in terms of, like, self-defense and, you know, just practical, like, how to fix a car if you need to, where to find gas, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Like, well, yeah, I mean, it there's a good focus on skills and things that allow you to be more independent. So, like, you know, right. One option is just move out somewhere in the middle of nowhere out west and buy some land and just kind of start your own thing and build, I'm seeing more like these events and courses that are focused on, like, how to build like a house or like, you know, applying, like, modern, like, 3D printing in order to create, like, tools and stuff to actually build your own, like, you know, infrastructure, mm-hmm. firearms training, just ways to be, you know, more sovereign and not having to rely on, like, this failing public infrastructure, like the society right. that's kind of, like, you know, that has these issues. And I think, you know, in a world where everybody's just, like, online a lot and kind of becoming more isolated, doing, you know, meeting up and actually having physical interaction and networking and meeting other people, is just a very healthy thing as humans that we should do.
Sure.
So I'm really glad that, that you got, you know, the Bitcoin meetup started, but you're doing these other things. I think it's really important to interact with humans in real life, not just online. So.
Oh yeah, man. Well, I second that. Sean, dude, I'm really grateful for you coming on here. I think this is an excellent conversation. I'm looking forward to talking to you more.
Yeah, man, this was great. You know, and, the, yeah.
No, what were you going to say?
No, well, I was just going to plug, I know you're doing this and, we're in the month mm-hmm. of May right now. We have, right. The Bitcoin 2021 conference coming up in June. So, like, you know, kind of playing to the theme of meeting people in real life. I'm really excited about that. I think it's going to be a really fun event, you know, in Miami. And I'm very much looking forward to it. We're doing a BitDevs meetup on June 2nd, which is that Wednesday. at, I think, about 3:45 in the afternoon at the lab in Miami. So if anybody's listening to this and wants to come out for that, you know, definitely check it out. There's, I think it's listed on the satellite events on Bitcoin 2021's website. The RSVP list might be full, but just show up. It'll be a really fun week in general. So I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Awesome, dude. Can't wait. Yeah, we've got a lot of things going on that week. The BitDevs is going to be on the Wednesday, June 2nd, and then the following day on June 3rd. Katie the Russian is putting on Citadel mini conference that we'll have in an undisclosed, to be announced location. We're going to have some people there talking about, like, just focus skill development type stuff around what you're, what we were just talking about, Citadel building. And then all the plebs are going to come into Wynwood and eat tacos, drink beer, and hang out for the Have Fun Staying Pleb party. At 7 p.m. that night on the 3rd.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, that's going to be it's going to be a great event. It's going to be a great day. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, man. It'll be great. Sean, thanks again, buddy. How can people find you if you...
I go by Sean Apps. Apps spelled APPS. I'm on Twitter, Telegram under that handle. So if you want to reach out, you can do so through those means. So
great. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. Sean. Well, thanks, Sean. Really good talking to you, man.
You too.
Bye.
Cool. I'll end it there.
Cool. Yeah, that was good, man. That was a good, that was a good talk.
Yeah.
It was fun. I don't know if I co-host Junseth's podcast. I don't know if I've mentioned that before.
Yeah.
I haven't done a lot of these discussions like this. So when I've done it with him, it's a little bit of a different dynamic, and he's kind of a character, but, it's fun doing this, having, you know, discussions and doing content. Mm-hmm. So yeah, man, this was good.
Yeah, man. Glad we got to connect. What's the podcast with Junseth? Is that
it's just on SoundCloud.
It's on SoundCloud. That's right.
Yeah. Like, it, you know, honestly, for us, it's always just been a fun thing we do. People that do this, you know, like that do podcasts, like, some people want to, you know, they want to grow it more. They just kind of want to do it just to have fun. Everybody's different. So for that thing, like, it's always just been a very fun, like, we don't really talk about it that much type of podcast. And honestly, like, for a while, like, we would talk about Bitcoin, but we'd talk a lot about politics and stuff. Like, I remember when when Alex Jones got kicked off of all the social media sites, that was a big thing we talked about. Hmm. So yeah, like, we haven't done a lot of episodes lately. The last one that he did, I wasn't on it, but he did do it with Isabella Kaminska. I don't know if you're familiar with who she is.
No.
She's a really interesting person to follow. She's a reporter for the Financial Times, and she's always been a very big Bitcoin skeptic, but, like, not in a retarded way, like, in a pretty intelligent way. Okay. And he had her on, and she's pretty much, within the last year, done a 180, and she's much more bullish on Bitcoin now.
How do you spell her last name?
Kaminska is, I think, Kaminska, something like that. If you search for, like, Isabella on Twitter, I mean, she's active on Twitter. But I can probably send you her Twitter. I'd send you the link to that episode.
Oh, nice.
They get in a lot of different conversation. And I think she's somebody that's, you know, also, she's British, but she has, like, that really sexy British voice. Like, I'm not usually a fan of that accent, but, like, she has the She just has a really nice accent. So I'll send you her Twitter too, just so you have it, man. But I'm gonna get going here, but I plan on coming out tonight, so I'll see you then.
Ah, nice, dude. Yeah, I'll see you there.
All right, cool. Later, man.
See you, bud.
Bye.
All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Sean. I'm just so glad that I got to meet him and hang out with him over the last few months. He's become a close friend, and I hope you gained from his insight and his knowledge and experience in Bitcoin so far. He's a really important partner to have here. As always, if you guys want to support the show, be sure to or feel free to like, subscribe, and share it with anyone that you might think might resonate with it. And visit thebitcoinpath.com to learn about other events and ways to contribute. I'm really passionate about just really focusing on the community here and providing space for Bitcoiners to meet in real life. So there's some really cool events coming up. Be sure to check that out. Also, for those of you coming out to Miami, remember about the pleb party that we're throwing on June 3rd at 7 p.m. Tickets are selling pretty fast, so be sure to snag one if you want. It's at plebparty.com. All the information's there, and you get 10% off with the code PLEBSUSEBITCOIN only if you pay with Bitcoin or Lightning. So I hope to see you guys there. If you'd like to connect with me, feel free to email me at info@thebitcoinpath.com. I also host a Bitcoiner meetup twice a month in Miami. So if you're in the area, I'd love to meet you there. Just look up Miami Bitcoiners on meetup.com. And until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.